Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
This is John West for ID the Future. The Texas State Board of Education is currently revising the state science standards, including how they teach about evolution. On January 21st, the board held a hearing featuring experts on both sides of the evolution debate. Dr. Stephen Meyer, director of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute, was one of the experts invited to testify. Here's the audio from the question and answer session with Dr. Meyer, where Dr. Meyer rebuts some of the misinformation being spread by Darwin's defenders.
Okay, I'd like to call Dr. Meyer back up. I know Ms. Leo has a question.
And Ms. Hardy.
And Ms. Hardy. We'll go to Ms. Leo. Thank you.
Dr. Meyer, I know you're far too gracious to defend your PhD from Cambridge University. I'm sure most board members would die for something like that. So I appreciate your qualifications, and I know that you have done a peer-reviewed paper on the Cambrian explosion, and that's been a topic of conversation this evening. So I would like you to respond to Dr. Wetherington, who said that the Cambrian explosion is not a weakness. And I also would like to, I'm not sure if you were involved in the 2003 process, but I've heard several comments that DI is a creationist group, that supposedly they did this deceptive thing on the SMU campus. And then it's just left hanging there. I sat here along with Ms. Knight and a few of us till the wee hours of the morning. Yes, and I appreciated that. And Dr. Bernal also did as well. And there's a transcript and there is a tape recording from all of those proceedings. In no instance did DI ever promote creationism or intelligent design to be put into the textbooks. In fact, I clearly remember people from the Discovery Institute not advocating and not suggesting, and emphatically so, that we do not put ID into the textbooks. But they were merely questioning that there were scientific weaknesses to each of those areas that our textbooks address, on peppered moths, on Haeckel's embryos, on Darwin's finches. I mean, I remember going through each one of those, and they were scientific. They were not religious. But, I mean, I would like you just to tell us a little bit, if Discovery Institute, now or then, ever promoting to put intelligent design into the textbooks. I mean, I have the transcripts. I don't recall this. And I would like you also to talk about the Cambrian explosion in your paper. I know they attacked Dr. Silkey's research. I don't know if you're qualified to answer that, but Dr. Hillis was asked about Dr. Silkey's research. So I think it's only fair that maybe you can speak to Dr. Silkey's research, since Dr. Hillis spoke for Dr. Silkey. And when he said that, why can't evolution do two or three things at the same time, perhaps one after another? So since Dr. Silkey obviously can't come back to defend himself, but it was asked of Dr. Hillis, I'd like you to answer it.
Can I ask just a rhetorical question? Do you all know what an argument from authority is?
Yes.
Okay. I said philosophers of science evaluate the logical structure of arguments. Okay. One of the things we just heard from two witnesses was a series of affirmations, what sometimes I call proof by confident assertion. And I understand that the University of Texas is a very prestigious research organization. We have some very qualified scientists on our side, too. And what the other side wants to say is, look, we're not going to explain anything to you, but trust us. We're the experts. We know. And I'm a member of the National Academy. Did you know on that list of 750, there's a member of the National Academy? There are members of the Czech Academy and the Russian Academy and the Polish Academy of Sciences. Now, we're not saying that we're the majority. What we're doing, in a sense, the dissidents that are represented here today are representing, we're the minority report within science. Dr. Hillis dismissed Michael Behe's argument about irreducible complexity on the basis of the opinion of a judge who ruled that the scientific community had found no merit in Dr. Behe, that is Professor Behe of Lehigh University, PhD from an Ivy League school in biochemistry, and the opinion of Professor Scott Minnick, the other expert witness there, who thinks that irreducible complexity is a challenge to evolutionary theory, who is a state university professor at the University of Idaho, who is an expert on the bacterial flagellum, and also one of the key people who discovered the type 3 secretory system, which is supposedly the precursor to the flagellum, which Minnick actually thinks, based on the genomics data, is a devolutionary byproduct or else a separate system. Okay, so there, what I'm saying is we may be outnumbered, but there are thoughtful, considerate scientists who have differences of opinion about all these same issues that were just outlined here. Let me just talk about the phylogenetic trees that Dr. Hillis was talking about. Okay,
would you just ask her question and ask about that? So why don't you stay with the her question?
All right,
please.
You want Cambrian explosion?
Mine was on Cambrian explosion.
Okay, Cambrian explosion. Dr. Hillis, just to show that there's no problem with the Cambrian explosion, it's not a problem. He threw out a real half-baked idea, the idea that increases in oxygen in the Precambrian somehow explain the origin of the Cambrian explosion. At best, the change in environment is a weak, necessary condition of a major radiation. But to explain the origin of new animal forms, you need genetic information. So please explain to me how a little more atmospheric oxygen is going to sequence nucleotide bases and produce all the specific sequences that are necessary to build new animals and new animal forms. It doesn't follow. That's a half-baked idea. But things like that, because of a gentleman's authority and prestige with a big school, are used to trump very reasoned considerations from people who are in dissent for good reason. Okay? The statement was made that the Cambrian explosion took tens of millions of years. I don't know if he's aware, but since the mid-90s, the Cambrian explosion has been redated. People used to think it was about 70, maybe 40 million years. Now the accepted range is between 5 and 10 million. And we've had direct contact with some of the leading paleontologists in China who think that where the best Cambrian beds may be, they're very finely graded. It's the Maoshan Formation in Chengjiang. And the scientists there think it may be much less than 5 million, maybe even within the window of resolution of the fossil record. Okay, essentially instantaneous from a geological point of view. Now, you know, somebody can get up and say, hey, these guys have no credibility because we know the Cambrian explosion took tens of millions of years, but that's not the accepted date. And he can just assert that and we look very bad sitting here for 2 hours listening to that kind of stuff. But the fact is there are considered and thoughtful people who are very well-credentialed scientists who have differences of opinion. And so you aren't going to serve your constituents well if you take the word. This trust me approach to science is not going to serve the students well. Even if we're really wrong, they need to have access to the counter arguments so they can assess them. Otherwise, you're going to get people blowing smoke at you, and that looks pretty impressive. As to our science education policy, sorry, you asked. In 2002, we were first asked.
Did he answer all your questions?
She asked about our position on intelligent design.
Yeah, I wanted to set the record straight.
Right.
In 2003.
At Discovery Institute.
There's a transcript if anybody wants to look it up.
Okay.
We were at Discovery Institute for the first time asked to testify at a hearing like this in Ohio in 2002. And it was a very similar kind of, what should the policy be on evolution? We have people at Discovery Institute who do what we regard as scientific research developing the theory of intelligent design. Douglas Axe, for example, Caltech PhD, longtime Cambridge researcher. He's doing work in molecular biology. He's published one of the papers. I also have friends who have published papers in that binder, and there are many who are very skeptical. I know this. Axe, very well-qualified guy, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, published in the Journal of Molecular Biology. He doesn't think that you can build new proteins through random mutation and natural selection and any other mechanism that's out there. He thinks it's a huge problem. Okay, but when we were first asked about what should the policy be, we've got people doing ID research. We think it is scientific, but we don't want that theory taught in the public schools. And we have our own reasons for that, because what happens is that people draw our scientists into these legal battles, like what happened in Dover, and it draws us off of what we want to be doing, which is discussing this at an academic level, at a university level, So when the Ohio State Board first asked us in 2002, we proposed that they teach evolutionary theory, but also teach the criticisms of the theory as they are in the scientific literature. And I would just call the bluff here, and I'd ask you all to go through those articles. The articles about junk DNA are legit. The Darwinian, neo-Darwinian, the modern Darwinian idea of how information is created is that there's a random trial and error process that would accumulate noise, junk, as well as signal. And there'd be more junk than signal. So when the non-coding regions of the DNA were first discovered, Francis Crick and others who had a Darwinian point of view, neo-Darwinian point of view, said, man, this confirms our understanding of how information would have been produced. It was seen as confirmation of a Darwinian prediction. Now that the situation has changed and those non-coding regions are understood to be functional and to be polyvalent, they have many functions, now suddenly there was never any prediction like that at all. This isn't a weakness. This is all irrelevant. And we dismiss it with a sleight of a hand. Back to Ohio. We propose...
Wait, we're not discussing Ohio.
Okay, but the point is, since 2002, we have had a consistent policy that what we want in science education is to teach the strengths of Darwinian evolution, teach the theory in its full glory, in its modern form, and that would include other forms of evolutionary ideas, self-organizational theory, punctuated equilibrium, but also teach the criticisms that are in the literature. That's what we proposed to Ohio in 02, what we proposed here in 03, and what we're proposing here today. We have a consistent record on that. We're not changing. That's our position on science education policy. It's a red herring to say otherwise.
Okay. I got Ms. Hardy, and then Snipe, and then I have some questions.
Two questions. One, how old do you think the Earth is?
I think it's 4.6 billion years old.
4.6, okay. And the other question is, whenever you were earlier speaking, you used the reference to the Zogby poll and the 82%. But I was curious if that had any reference to the analyze and evaluate, or if it were just simply the question, strengths and weaknesses, what would you suggest being taught in the public schools? Did they have a choice of evaluate and analyze or strengths and weaknesses, or did they just have strengths and weaknesses?
No, they didn't, Pat. The poll was taken around the time of your 03 hearings, and the issue at the time was strengths and weaknesses. So my point in recommending that you restore that language or add it where it's missing is just that it resonates with your constituents. You know, that wouldn't by itself be a good reason to do it, but given the other reasons that we outlined, we think it certainly doesn't hurt.
Okay, Ms. Knight?
Several questions. I want to know if there has been any laboratory research to document your words, half-baked ideas, when you were talking about what the other presenters made, or are you just kind of like armchair quarterbacking off of literature that was written at a previous time? Do you have actual laboratory evidence or experiments to support your point of views on these various weaknesses of evolution that you have talked about? And I also want, since there was a great deal made about decorum, we did not address decorum issues when he was countering what the previous speaker had said.
You're right. I shouldn't have said half-baked. Thank you. Yeah, that's a good point of correction.
Answer my question.
Yeah. I know the literature on the paleontology with respect to the Cambrian explosion. I'm not really asking you all to think about it. I mean, most of us understand what DNA is, and that you need the instructions in DNA to build the proteins to make the stuff of animals. So how does a change in atmospheric oxygen cause DNA to be sequenced in a particular way that would that would build any specific protein or structure? There's no causal connection there. So I don't think that's a serious proposal. And that maybe is the way I should have phrased it. And if you look in the literature among people who are concerned about this problem of the origin of body plans, I don't think there are many people who take that regard that as a solution. I think that, and I have found that as a pattern when people are trying to say, you know, you echoed Dr. Hillis's characterization of our challenge as being presenting discredited evidence, but. You can use discredited refutations to try to show that. And I think this just illustrates why we need an iron sharpening iron constructive dialogue. We can't allow one side in a controversial issue like this to define what's credible and what isn't. And it may well be that right now the people with the most senior credentials at the biggest universities are predominantly in favor of the contemporary version of evolutionary theory and want to reject, you know, the claim that there are serious challenges. But there are serious challengers who have serious positions, some of them very highly credentialed, and that's really a judgment call for you as a board. At what point do you want to allow students to know about that? Are you going to just go with the argument from authority, or are you going to say, this is a serious enough issue, and there are serious enough people on both sides of this, that we're not just going to count heads and decide that one side's got all the cards and the other one just needs to shut up and go away? That's no way to do science education, in my opinion.
So. Okay. But I don't think you've really answered my question in terms of actual, for example, Dr. Hiller said we could walk across the street and go into the lab and see some of the things being done now. So are you in a laboratory trying to replicate those things, or are you just looking at scientists who have read materials and are questioning how this could have happened?
Well, there is no replicable scientific experiment showing how oxygen produces genetic information. That's you know, we've been talking about theories and hypotheses. That'd be a conjecture. Okay, it's not possible for us to test it experimentally because nobody's done any work on it experimentally. It's a conjecture. But yes, there are people who agree with me who think there are scientific challenges to Darwinian evolution, who are doing laboratory research to expose those weaknesses in the theory. Dr. Silke is one of those. My colleague Dr. Axe that I mentioned, Dr. Sternberg, who's written extensively on junk DNA, has done lots and lots of the primary work, including work on these phylogenetic trees. So there is a considerable body of dissenting opinion about this. And that's why we think students should get to know about it. It's part of the discussion. I mean, imagine the judge essentially in Dover, and go back to that, essentially decides, well, the scientific community has decided there's no merit in this Michael Behe argument, so therefore the issue's settled. We have that cited authoritative. We have a scientist citing a judge to refute another scientist. But isn't Michael Behe a member of the scientific community? Did he cease to be a member of the scientific community because he had a different opinion about irreducible complexity than staunch neo-Darwinians or a judge who made the ruling? Did Scott Minnick cease to be a member of the scientific community because, you know, he's outnumbered, even though he's an expert on that particular system? That's the kind of thing that you can't, there's not an easy way to settle this, and that's why you have to let the argument proceed in a civil fashion within the classroom at an age-appropriate level. You can't just defer to one expert or to a judge. There's too many credible people who have a different point of view.
I'd like you to address the phylogeny. You know, the phylogeny was initially the anatomical similarities, so that's how we classified them. And then we had the proteins Ms. Lowe was talking about, and now evidently it's mostly the DNA. I've read where there's lots of conflicting things with different proteins that, like she was pointing out. Could you address some of those?
The textbook that we're not promoting here in Texas has a section on this. And there's a little sidebar. And I want to read something. It's from the National Academy of Sciences, their description of how this works. And they say this. They say the greater the differences, this is how molecular phylogenetic analysis works. You compare two pieces of DNA or two proteins, the products of DNA. And the greater the difference in the DNA, the longer the time two organisms, longer time ago, that the two organisms shared a common ancestor. So you compare those sequences and you produce this wonderful, these tree diagrams. Now, the interesting thing about that statement is that that's the conclusion of the analysis, okay? The phylogenetic trees showing relatedness, okay? Showing a historical pattern of descent with modification. But that same conclusion is the assumption that the computer program uses to analyze the similarity data. Okay, so it's formally is a form of circular reasoning. Remember I told you that one of the things philosophers of science do is they analyze the logic of evolutionary arguments. Well, this is one that's real suspect because you are ostensibly proving in the outcome the thing you had assumed in the input. And you may as well say at that point, well, you know, is that really evidence for evolution? You might say garbage in, garbage out. You've assumed common ancestry, and then you've developed a plot that shows common ancestry. And there are many people who have written on this within the technical literature. So you can have you can have 500,000 papers on that one topic, but if they all have the same flawed assumption at the base of the reasoning, then is it really establishing universal common ancestry? Is it really evidence for evolution in that sense? And secondly, yes, there are many conflicting evolutionary phylogenies. We discuss some in this chapter in our book, and there are definitely some in those papers, and I challenge people to look at them and not just allow them to be waved off with a flip of the hand.
One of my questions I asked Dr. Hillis was about information. If we start off with just simple life that has gradually changed to us, and the incredible complexity and the information that is in these molecules to be able to, and in the cell, for us to make all these different body parts and all the different things, our brains are so incredibly designed. It's a computer that could do what the human brain is just gigantic. Just, of course, electronics getting smaller, so I guess that computer's getting smaller. But anyway, my question, what do you say about the information that is used to design that? Can it be done by just the process described?
The information problem, I think, is the big problem in biology. Information runs the show in biology. And it's a problem at two levels. You need information to build the first living cell from the simple non-living chemicals. And you also need information to build new biological form from pre-existing forms of life. In the prebiotic case, the information problem is almost universally agreed among origin of life researchers to be the big stumper. Because you can't even invoke natural selection until you have at least a self-replicating RNA molecule. And to get self-replication capacity, you've got to have information. The molecules have to be sequenced properly so that those molecules could even get natural selection going. So before you get natural selection, you've got to have information. And it's a big, big problem. It's in the literature everywhere. Bernd Olaf Cooper's, one of the leading German origin of life researchers, has said that the origin of life is basically equivalent to the problem of the origin of biological information. And search the literature in vain, that problem has not been solved. Okay. Then at the higher level, if you want to build something like the new animals that come about in the Cambrian explosion, you can invoke natural selection, but there's still a problem. Because natural selection only selects for functional advantage. And it turns out that you've got to get a whole lot of things right in terms of the arrangement of all those A's, C's, G's, and T's before you have something that will confer a function that's selectable. And this is where the research of my colleague Douglas Axe has come in. He has done a very careful regime of testing to find out how probable it would be that you could build even not a full gene, but a protein domain that would be selectable by chance, because the chance variations have to occur before the later selectivity. And he's compared the odds of finding a single protein, a domain of about 150 amino acids, by chance, they're about the same as finding a cotton ball in the Milky Way galaxy. It gets a big, scary number, 1 chance in 10 to the 74. He's very persuaded that that presents a very big problem for the neo-Darwinian mechanism. He doesn't think the mechanism can produce the information you need just to build the proteins, let alone arrange the proteins into the higher-order structures that you need to build whole animals. So that's, again, another example of a very thoughtful, considered scientist who's done a long regime of experimental research who's come to a conclusion that makes him skeptical about Darwinian evolution, and it's precisely on the point you mentioned, the problem of the origin of information. In this case, the information you need to build new proteins even after life has begun.
Well, I don't know if you have any opinions on the origin of teeth and how teeth have come to function. Being a dentist, I've checked out the evolution of teeth. Just the latest October story says tooth evolution theory lacks bite. They talk about the theories of how we got upper teeth and lower teeth, that both theories hinge on the idea that there's an inherent difference in the inductive power of ectoderm and endoderm, and that migration of one or the other is a crucial factor. Anyway, it talks about migration of ectoderm to endoderm. I don't want to get into details, but that's not even a scientific term, how in the migration anything. Well, anyway, anything can migrate.
It just makes me nervous talking about teeth to a dentist. That's, I think we're just too close.
And how many people here have ever had a dentist put in, like I've done a zillion times, and left the filling high? You had a sensitive tooth, crown's high, and to have ectoderm or endoderm, which organ migrates in the embryologic stage, ends up popping up in a lower jaw to become teeth. And then you have exactly the same thing happen in the upper jaw, and all of a sudden, and now they perfectly fit together. I forgot to bring my occlusion textbook, which talks about all the details. Wouldn't that be a weakness of how you can explain how teeth are so incredibly fit together, and they have, there's no explanation at all of how that could have happened? What do you think about teeth evolution?
I just don't know much about that subject. I'm going to defer to you, but
well,
I don't want to end up in your chair here before I leave.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm...
Yeah, that's, you know, there's a lot of things like that. If you stop and think about them, it's not nearly as simple as, you know, the just-so stories will sometimes maintain.
I like that comment. Does anybody else have any more questions of Mrs. Dunbar?
Yes. I was just curious. Anyone who has been within the scientific community that's been intimidated to not teach the strengths of neo-Darwinistic evolution.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, of course. Okay. We know people that lost their jobs. This is one of the things we do at Discovery Institute.
No, the strengths, not
the weak. The strengths. No, not in the scientific community. The most biology departments are, you know, majority owned by the neo-Darwinian perspective. Okay,
so most
of the people that are in our network of dissenters are outnumbered. They're like 2 out of 14 in a department, or you know, 1 out of 6. So there's not many pressures not to teach the contemporary forms of evolutionary theory. And by the way, we're not critiquing Darwin in the 19th century. We're talking about either neo-Darwinism or the more current models of evolution. I do think, and this is a concession I'd make to our members opposite, is that I think there are some smaller communities where there is evolution is such a bad word that sometimes people, science teachers, are afraid to talk about because they're afraid they're going to upset religious sensibilities in the community. They don't talk about it. There's a point that Eugenie has made that I think is a legitimate concern about academic freedom, which is the equal and opposite point of the point we've been making today about the people being intimidated out of teaching about the weaknesses or challenges or criticisms or problems with the theory.
Right. And that aside, basically, just so you know where I'm going with this, my question is, as far as weighing the testimony within the scientific community, because we are being presented, obviously we have 3 experts on each side, but we also have the contention by certain polls, which it's been brought up that some of them may not have been done from a legitimate standpoint. But that the basic tenor within the scientific community is that the intimidation pretty much cuts only one way. In other words, there wouldn't be a lot of intimidation within the scientific community for anyone to come and testify to us as to teaching the strengths of neo-Darwinism. There would only be intimidation to not teach the weaknesses.
I think that's right. That's a reflection of kind of the demographics of the disagreement at this point. You know?
Okay, and so that brings me to this conclusion, because what we're dealing with today is goes beyond just presentation from the biology community or the scientific community, but basically the impact of the semantics of the words, strengths and weaknesses.
Okay.
And there's been some elements or some argument as to your particular credentials, but wouldn't it be fair to say that the logical result from a historical scientific framework as to the implementation of that verbiage, that you would be probably more suited to address that as far as the logical structure of arguments and the whole analysis of the implementation of that verbiage because of your background and your training and your PhD from Cambridge?
I'm not sure I'm following you the exact the question. It was maybe
okay.
It had too many clauses for
sorry.
Me. I'm sorry.
Occupational hazard.
No, it's all right.
Okay. Basically, to simplify it, because there was a question earlier, I believe, by my esteemed colleague, Mr. Craig, as to the fact that you don't actually have a quote-unquote biology doctorate. But from my vantage point, as far as what we're looking at is not just strict black and white biology, but also the impact of the implementation.
I got you. Yeah, yeah.
So based on
you want me to defend the relevance of my training for your present process.
Yes, yeah. Because based on the scientific historical analysis, you can look at how the scientific community has dealt with non-adherence versus adherence within the scientific community as a whole, and that you would be well suited to be able to address that from a professional expertise.
I think one of the things, who's going to hold the scientists accountable for circular reasoning? If everybody in a discipline uses certain methodology, but it doesn't really actually formally establish the proposition, it presupposes the proposition in the process of generating more demonstration of it, then what you get is you get a pressure for conformity within that discipline. We all do phylogenetic trees. They all mean evidence for evolution, except that the computer presupposed universal common descent, the kind of evolution you're proving in the program itself. Okay, that goes on all the time. Well, you know, so those sorts of things are, you know, historians and philosophers of science are relevant to this discussion. Same thing with the whole discussion of the scientific community. Who qualifies as the scientific community? Only the people that agree with a majority opinion? Are Behe and Minnick ipso facto non-scientific members of the scientific community because they have a different view and a judge said that they didn't agree with the community? So that's a semantic distinction. There's the majority scientific community, perhaps, on this. The minority. And there's probably a big silent middle that's not really saying where they're coming from or for whom the issue of evolution is just not that interesting. There's a lot of scientists who do bench science who just don't have, you know, they don't spend much time on this. So it's not, you can't just say, oh, well, we're gonna assume the authority of all those people that aren't saying anything. You know, they're on our side too. So there's a dispute, there's a clear argument, and that's, you can't decide who's right in that. But you can decide to expose students to it. You might decide, hey, one way we're going to handle this is we're going to label the dissent as the minority position within science. That'd be fine with us. But you can't say it isn't there, or that the people who hold these, you know, dissenting views are numbskulls or not qualified or anything like that. That's not fair.
And from a scientific historical viewpoint, would you not characterize the inability to discuss those issues as squelching scientific discovery?
Well, this is where my expertise in history of science comes into play. This is a classic, if you read Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolution, when scientists start resorting to authority, when they start labeling everyone with pejorative labels. I understand that I was called a creationist this morning, even though someone kindly got me to explain that I don't think the Earth was 6,000 years old. Okay, but you know, when those kinds of arguments are used, that's often a sign of a theoretical edifice that is weakening. Because, you know, if the theoretical edifice is strong, you make evidential arguments. You don't appeal to authority and to name-calling. So to me, that's a red flag just as an historian of science.
Thank you.
Don?
Mrs. Miller.
I'm going to ask you the same question. I'm saying, assuming tomorrow we're going to have a motion to add strengths and weaknesses back in, and you're saying very clearly that you all do not believe that ID or creation should be put in the biology science book.
We are most definitely not asking for that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, then do you have a problem with a qualifying statement, sir, that to make sure that the textbook, because the textbook publishers are telling me, you better believe we're going to bring ID and creation into the textbooks when it in a few years, because we know, we can see where the votes are on this board. Now, are you willing to agree?
When I first heard about your dilemma, I thought, well, they ought to just stipulate then. But, you know, now, make sure your stipulation isn't tendentious. Okay, I'm actually an advocate of the theory of intelligent design, but I'm doing it in my, you know, I've just written a book called Signature in the Cell, and it's going to be published, not for textbooks or anything. Okay. But, you know, so you don't need to be tendentious. You don't run those other ideas down. But you say what Dr. Garner said. This should not be construed as endorsing the discussion of intelligent design or creationism in the biology classroom. Boom, you're done. Okay? It's just straight language. You know, not dissing it, not lauding it, not making too big a deal out of it, just saying what you mean and what you don't mean.
Okay.
And it seems like that would be a great solution.
Thank you.
Okay, I think... Is there any other questions?
Thanks for your
I want to thank everybody for being here, the audience, all the board members. the decorum basically has been very good. Thank you for our experts. They're still here. We really appreciate your hard work for us. The meeting is now adjourned.
For ID the Future, this is John West. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.